Hi there, Shan Chi here, Executive Director at Byron Writers Festival. And you're listening to the Deep Dives podcast series recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. This session, titled Cult Trip, is a conversation between Anke Richter and Zachary Jane, calling for compassion and support.
Anke Richter is a columnist and reporter. Before moving to New Zealand from Germany with her family, she worked in newsrooms and television production companies in Hamburg and Cologne. Her investigative pieces are published internationally in such respected journals as Die Zeit, Spiegel, New Zealand Geographic, North and South, and many others. She has also published three books that are published in Germany, and she joins us here for this deep dive as she takes a deep dive into the murky waters of the cult. Please welcome Anke.
Thank you, Zach.
So, Anke, you looked at three, but you studied across a broad spectrum of cults, your research, but you looked specifically at three, and I will mention those and locate them first. The first one being Centrepoint, and the leader of that cult was a person called Bert Potter, and the second was Agama, led by someone who called himself a Swami, but his name was Narsis Takau, and third, Gloria Vale, led by somebody who called himself Hopeful Christian, then led by a person who is called Howard Temple, and interestingly has just been arrested.
Yeah, it's very topical at the moment, right?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But what I first wanted to start with is you begin by saying that you were once an enthusiastic participant, but now critically observe. You had skin in the game, you said. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I was never an enthusiastic participant in any of those cults that you mentioned, because the first one, Centrepoint, was a former sex and therapy cult in New Zealand and folded about 20 years ago. It was a massive scandal. Police raided the place. They had manufactured drugs, taken them with teenagers, lots of sexual abuse. And I got into cult journalism, and actually Centrepoint was my entry point, actually by participating here at a festival. I think at the time it was actually called the Sex and Consciousness Festival in Byron Bay, now called the Taste of Love Festival, and I went there as a bit of a skeptical participant, so dipping my toes in, and something clicked for me at the time. And at that festival, I also met a former teenager from Centrepoint who told me that she'd been Angie Micklejohn, that she'd been the commune concubine in this place in New Zealand, and I'd never really heard about it. I thought, what, a sex cult in New Zealand? And it was quite similar, Centrepoint, to a group that was operating in Europe, in Austria at the same time, with similar disastrous consequences. So I was familiar with the type of group, and I thought, what? They had this in New Zealand, and it's such a massive story. Met Angie again a year later or a few months later, and she started telling me her story of drug rape by the guru and grooming and losing herself in this whole world, prostituting herself later, becoming an alcoholic, and I thought, wow, I want to write your story.
That's how you got into it.
Into the cult journalism, but the enthusiastic participant was that because I went to the Taste of Love Festival, I got I became interested in the so-called sacred sexuality world and started doing some trainings and courses, mainly with ISTA, which probably people here are also familiar with to some degree. And that was sort of my own private journey while I was also researching a former sex cult, which is kind of interesting that that was parallel.
And that's one of the things that you explore in Cult Trip is the porous borders between cults and bona fide New Age groups and religions. And because it does get very, very murky, and we will be exploring this terrain, I wanted to offer up a trigger warning for anybody in the audience who may be feeling anxious or sensitive about this topic. There may be discussions that do trigger some difficult feelings. If there are, please seek help. turn to friends, turn to trusted confidants. We have the number for Lifeline, which is 131114. And I'll read that out again at the end of the session, but please be aware that we will be discussing some very difficult topics.
Thank you for that. I'll try not to be too explicit, but then my book deals with a lot of sexual abuse and child sexual abuse, yes.
And you said that sexuality plays a central role in all of the three cults that you explored in detail, that you researched in detail. Why?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't really think that with Gloryvale so much. With Centerpoint, it was always seen as a sex cult, and that's a bit of a murky term in itself. It was a therapy cult where open sexuality was propagated, and there were lots of problematic aspects to that. But it was foremost a therapy cult, and also like a free love cult. Agama Yoga, still going, by the way, in Thailand, is a tantra, a yoga tantra cult, but also with a heavy focus on neo-tantra and sexuality. So they were even labeled a rape cult because they had a massive scandal in 2018 where 31 women came forward in reports about transgressions, and I was there as a reporter on the island. So they have that label slapped on them. And Gloryvale, though, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's been a bit of media, and they're really quite a unique cult because of their blue uniforms, and they're very strict, modest, highly regulated, highly repressed culture of communal living in a very fundamentalist way. But sexuality plays a massive role, actually, which is not so obvious from the outside because they don't look like the wild hippies or so. So that's the bind.
How they present themselves is strictly regulated. They have a uniform that actually the basis for the production design of Margaret Atwood's
Handmaid's Tale
series. Dramatization of The Handmaid's Tale. So very similar outfits.
Not just the outfit, but I what I learned through my interviews, and especially women who've left Gloryvale and their horrific stories of basically being breeding machines and being available for their husbands who, you know, from arranged marriages from when they were late teens, pretty much. Their stories, I thought I had entered Gilead, The Handmaid's Tale. And it was my conclusion at the end of my research, actually. I mean, over the years, over 10 years, I dipped in and out of these groups and then pulled it all together finally. And this is actually when I had the realization, Gloryvale is also a sex cult, if you want to use this term. But sexuality is controlled in every cult across the board, not just in the so-called sex cults. It's a means of control. It's either distorted, it's either amplified, or it's suppressed. If you think of groups like Heaven's Gate, where some men even castrated themselves because they were preaching complete asceticism, and you have groups like Hare Krishna or Sri Chinmoy, also very, very anti-sexuality. And then you have other groups like the so-called sex cults, or, you know, Children of God, Centerpoint, where the pressure to be as sexual as possible in ways that are totally unethical and harmful is also, it's not a joyful thing. It can become a horrific means of control. So sexuality always plays a role in all cults to some degree.
You say they defined what their people's sex lives should look like. So sex lives, patriarchal male leaders, lots of misogyny. How do you draw the line between that, a cult, and some forms of fundamental religion, Christian religions, where sexuality is highly controlled?
It's a blurry line. I mean, some people say religion is just cults plus time. I'm not quite sure about that, because cults stand for a certain level of oppression. And, I mean, there isn't the one checklist. And you have to be careful with these sort of markers of what makes a cult. There's some very general things that definitely apply. But if you go too much by, it's got to have this and this and this, and if they don't all wear on the compound and wear the orange robes, well, then it's not a cult, and that's wrong. So Religion and cults. I mean, I'm not a scholar. I'm not an expert on cults. I'm just a researcher and someone who's experienced a lot myself. But there are definitely cultic dynamics in religion, but there are also a lot of the cultic dynamics that we're seeing, that I've researched, I also see in other parts of society. I don't know if you're familiar. I'm originally from Germany. I don't know if you're familiar with the German mega band Rammstein. They've just had a massive scandal in Germany about apparently drug raping some of their fans and the after parties and whatnot. And the whole thing is no different. The patriarchy, the whistleblowing of some women who are brave enough, the shutting down by the others, the victim blaming, the doing business as usual because there's big money involved, the projecting on the leaders. I mean, the same stuff, and that's not even religious. So it's not for me so much about let's differentiate between cults and religions. Cult is a tricky term, and the cult experts actually like to use the word high demand or high control group. So if you strip it away from the spirituality and the religious meaning, a high control or high demand group doesn't even have to come with religion. Multi-level marketing companies are quite culty. There are life coaching programs that are cults. There are crypto cults. And again, it's not about the content. It's not about the wacky belief or what they look like. Or, you know, I mean, some beliefs lend themselves more to being cultic, because if you only believe that the earth is flat, then you might also believe that your divine leader is the direct, has direct transmissions from God and knows everything that you should be doing. But it's not about the content. Therefore, it is always about the power structure, the dynamics, the leadership, the level of groupthink, the lack of internal criticism. That's the stuff. We have that in religion too, by the way.
Yeah. We can look at cult of personality, where people think that whole elections have been stolen. People in powerful countries, and they lead folk allegedly to storm the Capitol. So, what kind of people are involved in cults? There's a general assumption that it's somebody who is needy, who is weak or damaged. You actually spoke to quite a well-known former cult member, the supermodel and actor Holt Richards in America, who said, "There is no profile. Anyone can succumb." Where were you when you met Holt Richards, and what do you think of what he said?
I met him at a cult conference in Manchester in 2019.
A cult conference?
A cult conference.
This is where you go to find a cult you want to join?
People don't join cults. They delay, I'm just quoting a cult expert here, they delay something that has been misrepresented to them. And a cult conference, because, I mean, there are cult studies is an academic field that's been going for decades. There's some great cult experts. There are lots of people who do studies on cults and, you know, in religious studies. And cult conferences, they are run by, this specific one is run every year by ICSA, not to be confused with ISTA, even though it sounds very similar, International Cultic Studies Association, and they invite speakers. I was going to speak there as well in the pandemic, and then it fell through. And survivors as well, and people who have something to do with the whole topic. And it's a great way of bringing people together to talk about these topics. And this is where I met Hoyt, the former supermodel who was in a doomsday cult. And I mean, he is the prototype of the good-looking, successful, Princeton-educated star of the 80s, who certainly wasn't lacking in attention, money, friendship, and he was involved in a cult where he thought an extraterrestrial would save his life. So luckily he extracted himself. And when you asked before which kind of people join cults, I was going to say people like you and people like me. Because that's true. There are people who are curious in life, who want connection, who may be seeking, who can be passionate about new ideas, about community. It's not people who are weak and stupid. And I think it's really important that we change this misconception about people who are in cults, because it's so easy. And this is what I actually learned from Hoyt, because he said, because he had the same image of what typical people in cults look like, it just never landed for him that he wasn't one, because it can't be him, because he's who he is. I was a cult journalist at the time when I drifted into groups that now some people see as cults, yeah? So even that didn't, you know, prevent me from being enthusiastic about something, because everyone has an Achilles heel, and that's not even necessarily a weak spot. It's more like it could be a temporary, like a temporary vulnerability almost. Let's say someone in your family died, or you had a health crisis, or, something's changed, or you moved to a new place. A lot of people, when they start a university, there's often a recruiting ground for cults, because they've left home, they're looking for new connections. They're not all lost and stupid and weak people. It's just that there is an opening where something can land. And I had that opening at the time when I went to the Taste of Love Festival. And it wasn't just the festival, but around that time in my life, whereas 10, 15 years earlier, neo-tantra and all of that, I would have gone, oh, stay away. You know, this is so gross or weird or whatever.
You're a hard-hitting journalist.
Yeah, but also just sort of in my personal life, maybe there was something that I thought, wow, this is how I can be. This is how I can feel. And then I was hooked in. It wasn't like something where someone was even actively doing that for me. No one was trying to recruit me. I fell in love with something. And this is how it normally is.
Yeah.
Cults don't feel like bad places when you're in there. This is why people say, oh, I would never be in a cult because I would. No, you would be, because if you think you'd never be in one, you probably would be in one, because you don't see that. Mm. They don't announce themselves as cults. And they always feel great. There's always something good to get.
Yeah, yeah.
If this was just bad from the get-go, no one would be in there.
So it's a lot like a relationship at the beginning.
Yes.
The love with a narcissist.
Totally. There's a love bombing.
There's the love bombing, and slowly, slowly the red flags appear.
Well, not just any old relationship. I would say it very much resembles domestic violence or a narcissistic abuse kind of relationship, where you have the love bombing and then you put up with the abuse, and you're still hoping for that initial love that you had, and it takes so many cycles of getting out of it. And again, you can apply that to why didn't they just leave the cult when they knew that their leader was a fraud or he was sleeping with all the women? It's not that easy. There's already such an investment, not just in terms of you've moved your whole family there, or you gave all your belongings to this, or you told all your friends this is the best thing ever since, you know. No, it's also there is this emotional bond and this spirit, and this is why they talk about spiritual abuse. You've believed in something. This has given you so much, and suddenly that begins to crumble. It's devastating. People can go into psychological breakdowns, and I've interviewed people who, you know, a woman after coming out of Sri Chinmoy, she tried to kill herself just because it's so hard to reconcile the outside world with what you believed in and what you gave everything for, and you don't have an education, you don't have money, you come out. So it's this complexity that I really want to just raise more awareness and compassion for, that we stop doing this weird. I know cults are a hot topic right now. People love a good cult doco and a good cult book, right? But let me tell you, you're going to get some of that in my book too. But my real mission here is to actually stop the whole us versus them thing, because that's what cults do. Yeah, and actually think that we are these people. Yeah, we all, I guess most here, love a good yoga class or meditation course or an alternative music festival or so. It's we most of us move in these spaces, and there's nothing wrong with those spaces. But I think we have to understand that some people in some groups really take advantage of this need or this joy or whatever we're coming here for.
Curiosity, empathy,
learning,
and authenticity.
Yeah,
they take advantage of that.
All of that.
It was quite interesting when you say it's the cults set up an us against them. There was a heartbreaking section, I think it's in the Gloria Vale part, where one of the women, well, some of the people from Gloria Vale escape, or they leave with nothing, and a perfect stranger picks them up in the car and drives them and helps them.
That was the
And they say, we didn't think a stranger in the outside world would ever do that for us, because we were told that people were selfish and would hurt us.
Oh, more than that. When you're raised in Gloria Vale, you honestly believe that the outside world is the devil, is evil. It's so, I mean, especially if you're raised there, if you've grown up there and you don't know better. I mean, there's a new generation. I just hope, because of internet access and the current court cases and all the activism that's been happening in the last years, things are changing there. And you can't just keep these kids and young people as ignorant. But for the first maybe at least decade or so of your life and longer, you honestly believe this is the world. And that in itself is spiritual abuse, yeah? Mm. To raise people with such fear that if they step outside, something terrible is going to happen to them. And then Theo, who I met, who questioned started questioning things in there as a teenager, which a lot of them do, especially the girls, because they're so subjugated. It's such a deeply misogynist place. A lot of them are suicidal, the girls. They lose their hair. They have eating disorders. There is so much pressure on them. They're being shunned. They're being ostracized within the community. So when Theo... So when Theo finally got out, it was such a switch to her to see the people out there are actually not what she's been told all her life. People can be nice and helpful, but it's a massive culture shock. They're like refugees from another country.
In Gloria Vale, are the children educated? Do they go to the local school?
They're not a local school. They have the Gloria Vale school, and that, again, is a massive problem in itself because the girls don't get any higher education. The kids all work. They're slave labour. They've just been court cases around that. They're massive human rights abuses there. And the New Zealand Education Board, their reviews have come too late. People have turned a blind eye. I mean, don't get me started on the things that New Zealand, I guess maybe society in general, hasn't learned from a place like Centrepoint 20 years before. Here we have the same situation again on sexual child abuse, oppression, you know, all sorts of violations of labour laws and whatnot, exploitation. And the authorities have just sort of, you know, stood by. And I think it is because it's a Christian cult and it sort of looks so proper. And they're a big economic player in New Zealand.
Well, let's take it back then to Centrepoint.
Yeah.
Can you step us through...
Yeah.
How you came across Centrepoint, mm-hmm. what their fundamental teaching was, and then just a very quick version of how they fell apart.
So I've already told you that I went to that festival here in Byron Bay. This is how it all started, and I met someone from Centrepoint. That was Angie Micklejohn, who'd lived there with her family. And hundreds of people, thousands probably, have moved through Centrepoint, and hundreds have lived there. And the children very early on were separated from the families because they had this belief that it's better to, you know, if the old family model is bad and it's oppressive. And I mean, this was the 1980s, and New Zealand was a very, especially sexually repressed society. And I totally get the need for renewal and for the human potential movement that Bert Potter brought back from places like Esalen. And so all the intentions were actually good, that they wanted to create something better. They wanted to live in a community. So they started this place.
Can I just say, Bert Potter, the leader of Centrepoint.
The leader of Centrepoint, self-proclaimed therapist.
He took some inspiration from the Rajneesh.
From Osho. Back then he was called Rajneesh Bhagwan. That's right. Yeah. He went to his ashram and probably thought,
some Rajneesh.
Rajneesh movement. So this is where Bert Potter went back in the days. He was a pest control salesman and the smart
A pest
guy.
Control salesman, not
Isn't
the Messiah.
Right, not the Messiah. But then, he called himself God. His followers called him God. They were actually managed to be registered as a religion in New Zealand. And I mean, they were quite radical for their time. And also, don't forget, Bert Potter, the social services sent women especially to him for therapy because he was seen as the guy with all the new therapies. Because at the time, if you wanted some kind of sexual counselling or marriage counselling, it was only offered through churches, pretty much. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much around. So he really represented something new and progressive and wild, and then they started this community, and it was a big deal. And then there were rumours quite early on already about the sexualization of children. So their really warped philosophy was that it's healthy for children to be around adults who are having sex. Everyone slept in big open rooms. There was, it was a real pressure on everyone to have open relationships. So pretty much all couples that arrived in families, they all split up. It was a very, very promiscuous place. And it was also normalized that children would be involved in that. There were some awful predators. One of them was Bert Potter, who initiated, as a 60-plus-year-old man, initiated a lot of the young girls. So you can imagine the kind of trauma, the intergenerational trauma, the family divisions of, mothers basically pushing their, not just mothers, fathers, let's not just blame the mothers, where were the fathers, right? Parents pushing their children into the guru's arms because that would also give them more status as being sexually free parents. It was such a cesspool of, a warped ideology countered by, a lot of pressure from the outside with a society that, you know, also was probably coming down quite hard on them instead of actually really looking deeper at why was all this happening in the first place. So
you write of one couple who, as a gift to her husband, she brought a young woman, an underage, a girl, as a birthday gift.
Yes.
For her husband.
I met that person. I met the husband.
Was he
and
innocent?
I met the girl.
Was he sorry
the girl.
For what
I met,
he'd done?
I met a lot of people who, from all sides. No, and he was also the convicted abuser of another woman who told me her story of what happened to her. For that's Louise in my book, right? She was probably one of the most violated girls in Centrepoint when. I don't want to go into too much details, but anyway, she told me her story when she was in her late 40s. For the very I was the first person she ever told her story to, and I wasn't prepared for that, and also for what that did to me. And I met her abuser later on for an interview. He was quite open about, you know, because it wasn't a secret who he was and that he'd been in jail. He was the leader's son. And I was actually shocked by the lack of insight. I had to confront him with what I knew, how he's destroyed someone's life. And this has been, it's been an, so my book's not just straightforward reporting, right? It's, I immersed myself into this whole aftermath of this, into this labyrinth of unresolved trauma, and it had all been shoved under the carpet. In Germany, where I come from, we have a word called Vergangenheitsbewältigung, which is the term.
I was hoping you'd say that. I didn't want to have to pronounce it.
No, I'm helping out here. But, because it's I use it in the book as well, because it stands for coming to terms with a difficult past, clearly, you know, the Third Reich in that case. But it's something that maybe Kiwis, you know, being the nice, lovely, let's all get on with each other kind of culture that they are, not as confrontational or maybe problem-oriented as Germans, that's not really a concept that's popular in New Zealand. And I think a lot of things were just shoved under the carpet for years. And then here I came, maybe quite naive, thinking I could just write a book about all this. And then I got myself into, you know, I got too close to perpetrators as well as victims, and then my own conflict. It was really messing with my head, like, you know, trying to see it from all sides. And you can't, because you hear someone's story and then that contradicts what you hear from another person. Some of the nicest, most cooperative people I met, I then heard, had done some horrible things. And some of the most difficult people, one of them actually who tried to stop my book and my publisher at the time and you know, send me legal threats, had been one of the victims. And she was just so threatened by someone would go near her story and she wouldn't have control over that. I triggered PTSD in people who were, who'd been whistleblowers, and I thought they'd be so happy to hear from me, a journalist finally telling their story that they wanted to bring the place down. And no, you know, that was, it was such a, it was such a fraught, and still is to some degree, a fraught environment. And I stepped into that, and definitely a bit of more than I could choose. So my story, my book, is also the story of the failure of the first book I was going to write about Centrepoint, which I had to give up after 2 years.
Tell me how the what you have included in the book, I imagine, is just the tip of the iceberg.
It's the tip of the iceberg, and also what I could sort of safely tell.
What you had permission to tell.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think it tells enough, eh?
It was, just reading it was grueling.
Yeah.
Some of the... Yeah. And I was wondering how you managed yourself, this vicarious trauma, onlooker's trauma. How did you handle all of that?
Not well. Mm-hmm. No, not at all. Because, you know, I've been a journalist for 30 plus years, but I'm not trained in dealing with sexual abuse. I'm not a psychologist. I don't get supervision. I'm a freelancer. And at the time, even though I had a book contract with a great publisher, but my editor who'd signed me up, she'd left the publishing house and was completely on my own during the hardest time of all this. And my closest allies became the victims, the survivors. And that's a slippery slope for journalists. You're supposed to have that, always have that distance. But then for the kind of story or the kind of research I was doing and getting it so close to people, I mean, I had to get close to actually, you know, for someone like Louise to actually trust me and tell me a story. I had to sit there with her and cry and really feel what she that she trusted me. Yeah. So I did not deal with that well. It did have a bad effect on me. I was later diagnosed with PTSD, and I was just an overwhelm at some point. And then there were legal issues, and I gave up. So I didn't do so well. Yeah.
Is Louise the girl in the caravan?
Yes, she's the girl
in the caravan.
I actually wanted to name my book after her. That was one of the titles floating around, was The Girl in the Caravan.
Yeah, who had created a labyrinth so that she could sleep at night.
With junk,
without men coming into the caravan and forcing themselves on her.
Yeah.
So she had booby traps set up and tunnels of junk that only she knew the way around
old
in the dark.
Typewriters and
tripwires. And she was how old?
11.
She was 11.
Yeah, but the abuse started the year before when she arrived,
Yeah. And you were saying you spoke to a Canadian cult expert who said power is the primary currency, misogyny is the context, and rape culture is the landscape.
That's Matthew Ramsky, he's great.
It seems that it's the epitome of a power imbalance, and yet the people who have been involved can often still refuse to acknowledge that, even though they've spent time in jail. You also spoke about you went back to the centre point setting, the centre point location, which is now...
It's called Kawai Pura Pura, and it's a beautiful wellness retreat clinic, you know, naturopath clinic.
It's been reclaimed.
How did they cleanse the land? Well, they had cleansings and Maori ceremonies. And actually, when I was there, I mean, that's a bit of a story in the book, because also that when I was there, there were some First Nations people from Canada, and they felt something was off. And then I told them why I was there, and they felt something was off with the land. Or there's the woman I spoke to saw some troubled, stressed, some teenagers in distress in her dream that night. So, and they took me into this ceremony where I actually ended up just crying and hugging a big tree, and so there have been attempts to clean the land. But then if you ask someone like Louise, and you know, I told her that I'd done this ceremony and I was so moved by that, and she said, you know, you can do as many ceremonies, it's still like a, you know, it's like a toilet, you can flush it, but there's more coming in. And there's still a lot of unhealed stuff from Centrepoint. I mean, at the time, I thought I had failed with the book. No one had written such a book before, and I didn't make it. And people like Louise and Angie were quite disappointed, of course, you know, that I wasn't able to put that out. But I wrote The Making Of for North and South, big magazine in New Zealand. And the roll-on effect from that were two documentaries, one about Angie and one on TVNZ, which you can watch, called Heaven and Hell. And also an organization that a woman, a former child from Centrepoint, started, called the Centrepoint Restoration Project, to actually empower the former children to share their stories. And they wrote an open letter in 2020 when the documentary came out, actually basically asking the first generations for an apology, for some kind of accountability. And these things are still happening. So I think there has been a roll-on effect from my failed attempt to dive into this big story.
What I found was very interesting with the Centrepoint location is the reasonably objective head of the new wellness centre said, as they cleared back the brambles and the overgrowth from what used to be quite a beautiful setting for Centrepoint, the irony of the beauty of the setting, the ugliness of the content, their workers would get sick.
Yeah, I mean, but then you also don't know how much it's being projected. I've also heard of, you know, people having all sorts of reactions in a house where they thought that was Bert Potter's house, but he actually never lived in the house. So I'm a little bit careful with some of that.
Difficult to tease out hysteria and projection from what actually happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a fine line to walk, huh? And on that topic, because you read out that quote from Matthew Ramsky before, just jumping a bit to, because that was said in the context of Agama Yoga, because like Bert Potter, the Swami of Agama Yoga in Thailand, considers himself a sexual healer. And And that quote about, you know, power being the currency and rape culture being the landscape and so on, that's you know, it's no different to what happened with, you know, around Harvey Weinstein. But Harvey Weinstein at least didn't consider himself a sexual healer. And I think that's also always, I mean, at least with these kind of cults, it's also in the mix that people are not just being exploited and harassed and molested, but there's also that promise of healing and the most deepest personal intimate level. So that again, that comes with so much shame, and it takes so much more to then disclose the kind of abuse and the kind of rape that happens in those spaces, especially if it's been in a sexual healing session or a yoni massage, or, you know, it's so much harder than to just go to the police and just report what happened to you when you were in this naked massage where someone's, you know, striking your genitals, and explain that to the police in Thailand, for instance, as a foreigner. You know, this is why I have, you know, I really want to raise, you know, some more awareness about why a lot of these cases never see the light of day or don't end up in the media or don't end up in the courts, because you have that level of spiritual bypassing also, where it's sort of spiritualized abuse. Oh, you attracted that, or, you know, you're just speaking from your wounding and this is why you're so upset, or maybe it's a gift that this happened to you because it shows you, you know, where your shadow is and all this stuff. And then and you have the whole shame level of exposing something around your own sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I can relate to that because I moved in a group where, you know, I now also feel vulnerable thinking, oh my God, I did this and I did that, but I'm also the reporter. You know, I get it, even though it was very low level compared to, you know, other people.
I'd like you, if you could, to tell us about Bea Schofield, who Bea Schofield is and how you came across her.
Right. Bea Schofield is an American gonzo journalist, a bit of a cult buster who I was sort of not looking up to, but very fascinated by her. She's a freelance journalist, doesn't come from journalism, but is more an activist journalist. And she's been busting a lot of people in her, you know, just her own online stories. And she was the one who actually brought a lot of the tantric, neo-tantra teachers down. And she broke the Agama Yoga story. It was actually her. And then The Guardian and me, we were the first ones sort of on the scene to report about it for the national media. But she has a lot of enemies because she's seen as too sensationalist. I don't always agree with her style, but I think she's an important force in this whole world of cult journalism, which we don't have a lot of cult journalism with far and few people. It's more now. It's more becoming a...
What was the word? Cult journalism. Cult journalism.
Like sports journalism culture journalism. I think it's a genre that needs to grow and needs to do better.
Yep.
Because the new age field, the wellness industry, it's a big unregulated market, and it should have good journalism. It should be taken seriously. And I think a lot of my colleagues are a bit like, I mean, it's natural because we're very factual, and they scoff at the esoteric world. And I think that's a massive blind spot.
Or sensationalist.
Yeah, maybe not necessarily, but in the past, a lot of journalism about cults has been always very focused on the evil gurus and sensationalists in that sense, but not so much interested in why people are there in the first place, yeah, and the complexity and the nuance. Also, if you look at some of the cult docos that have now come out, there's some really good ones, like The Vow or so, you know, where you actually get to understand why are people there in the first place. I mean, if you tell someone, I don't know if you're familiar with this cult, Nexium, that's what The Vow is about.
Nexium,
yeah.
Nexium.
The big cult story in America a few years ago with Keith Raniere, this self-proclaimed, you know, life coach, women ended up being branded with his initials on their skin. You might have seen the front page of the New York Times, and one of the survivors, she runs a great podcast called A Little Bit Culty. I can highly recommend that. Anyway, if you hear that, women were branded with the initials of the guru, like who would do that? But if you actually really understand, and this in some docos like The Vow about Nexium do that really well, where you actually, and I try to do the same moment, where you actually understand what gets people in the first place and how it's so innocuous and a lot of things are really appealing. And then like years later, some people are so under the psychological control of this group or the leader or what they believe in that they would voluntarily put themselves into a situation where you from the outset would think, never ever would I do that. I think this is the thing that we need to understand better instead of ridiculing and shaming and just going, ooh, isn't that weird in those cults?
The one thing that isn't surprising, I suppose, is that these cults attract a lot of money. And I'm just concentrating on this page here. You talk about 2019 with Gloria Vale, and you say that year the Christian Church Community Trust, that's the Gloria Vale Trust, that's a tax-free trust.
Charity.
How they have charity status, made a profit of almost $2.8 million. Since the cult doesn't borrow money according to their beliefs, the tax-free charity had to pay the purchase off over time. Helped by a total of $4.5 million, it receives in government subsidies and funding each year. Tightening the food budget, their assets have now grown to $50
million. Yeah, it's quite a shocker,
isn't it?
That's
the Gloria Vale.
That's
what do the governments do? Do we have an agency in Australia that supervises this kind of thing?
No, and not in New Zealand either, and I think it's really, really needed. And a lot of cults are registered charities, and Gloria Vale had a review with the Charities Commission a few years ago, and they didn't really find enough. I mean, it just baffles me that so many things are so clear. But then maybe this is why cult education is actually important. I think it should be in schools, just like sex education, that we understand those dynamics of coercive control. Because then you also understand if you go into a group like Gloria Vale as, say, the police to investigate something, if it actually ever comes to the point where the police is being called, because normally they just deal with it all in-house, right? Then if you don't understand that people there, especially the women or the girls, will not talk to you, they will just tell you what the leaders have told them to say. You're not going to get the same witnesses
what happens
on the outside. So people don't understand these dynamics and think they can just deal with it like they would with...
What would happen if they spoke out? Let's say Gloria Vale.
They don't. It's so you would be ostracized. You would be. I mean, I know of a 9-year-old girl who was sexually abused by the school teacher there, 60-plus-year-old school teacher. She was brought in front of a group of men. So they have these servants and shepherds. They're all older men, 12 of them, and they were talking down at this 9-year-old girl for I don't know an hour or two to make her forgive the perpetrator. That's how they deal with this inside. And then it's fine, then they don't need to call the police because the girl's forgiven.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the way, it's not just Gloria, but I just want to say Jehovah's Witnesses and Exclusive Brethren and other groups pretty much operate along the same lines. Gloria Vale is more in the spotlight because of what they wear, and they kind of have this whole sort of freak show factor or cuteness or whatever you want to call it because of the uniforms. But the dynamics, the shunning, the misogyny, the brainwashing, the oppression, it's across the board in other groups like Jehovah's Witnesses and Exclusive Brethren too. Yeah, just want to...
Yeah.
Point that out.
So you went to all of these places, but you also went, and talking of the money and following the money, follow the money. You also went to the latest incarnation of Osho.
Oh, the cash ram.
The cash ram
in India. Okay. So, yeah, my book has a lot of darkness, but there are also some lighter moments. So
while you focus on that.
Let me take you there, yeah.
Yes, there is a lot of light in it because it's a personal journey, because you discussed, you are self-reflexive, you locate yourself, you locate your own relationship with your lovely and long-suffering husband, I would say. and you both went to this...
It's called the Osho, the Osho International Meditation Retreat, the former ashram of Osho / Bhagwan Rajneesh in Pune, which some of you who watched Wild Wild Country, you know who the guy is, but that was not the place in Rajneeshpuram, Oregon, but the original place in India. So it's now a very slick Zen-style meditation resort, costs heaps of money, you've got to buy a maroon gown, even if you're only there for a day, and a white gown for the evening sessions in this big UFO sort of type pyramid temple that was designed sort of by Osho. Looks culty as hell. And and they pat you down. There's all these security things. So back in the days, Osho was obsessed with, you know, perfume and bodily hygiene and whatnot. So they have all these rules about what you can and cannot do and what you're supposed to wear when you go into the temple. So I was curious about this place, and my husband and I, we went on a second honeymoon after 20 years of marriage. We went to India, and we thought, let's just go and check this place out as well. And I was always curious, maybe also because of my growing involvement or own explorations in the Neo-Tantra world, and I met a lot of people who I actually really liked, who had been inspired by Osho. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, I know he ran a cult, but maybe I want to understand why good people went there in the first place. So I went there as a sort of a cult tourist in some ways. And also, for my excuse, I have to say that was in 2017. At the time, we didn't know what we know now, that Osho was a serial sexual abuser who had a hit list of, you know, who would be killed if they spoke out about this. I didn't know about the level of also sexual abuse of children and teenagers in his cult. This has all come out in the last 2 years. So just want to state that, you know, that I wish I had known. Maybe I wouldn't have gone there. I don't know. I'm conflicted about this. So I don't want to make light or fun just out of this whole movement, because there's some pretty serious issues there, apart from their, you know, bioterror mass murder attacks in Oregon and so on. Anyway, I'm at the Kashram. I got my first session with someone, pressing all my acupressure points, and had a big release and a bit more at peace, because I was quite rebellious as soon as I got there. All these rules, a lot of verboten, you know, even for a German. I was just so like, oh, where am I? Felt so restricted. Certainly didn't feel like a sex cult, you know. There was nothing loose. There were no hammocks, no cuddle zone. It was all very, you can't sit here, can't do that, got to pay extra for that. And so, yeah, it's like, oh, God. So I'm finally in a better space of mind, but then my blissful state of peace is over once I'm inside the UFO pyramid again. So that's the evening meditation, where they show you Osho on a big screen. Because it's so chilly in the auditorium that evening, I have put on a light gray silk dress under my white robe. Not quite subtle enough, though. Yeah. One of the guards taps me on the shoulder. He wants me to go outside and take off the dress underneath immediately. Wrong color. It's distracting, he tells me with a stern face. At least he doesn't hit me with a Zen stick. Osho's video talk that night is about women, how they're way ahead of men because they have more love and operate more from the heart than the intellect. Women can become enlightened quicker, while men can become Alexander the Great. The audience laughs in the hall and on the recording, but Osho the Great has lost me from there. The women's movement, he says, is led by stupid women, because what we really want, in his view, is just a nice house with a pool. I wish we could end the show with a healthy debate about Osho's anti-feminism, but there's no such thing on offer. Love it or leave it is the only way. We head to the outdoor disco to shake it all off. Every day before lunch, a DJ plays in the Buddha Grove. Osho said that if you must decide between celebration and meditation, you should always go for celebration. That sounds like a good option. See, I was always trying to embrace some things again, even though it was trying to find the middle ground. My husband has just finished a Tai Chi class and joins us. We jump and twitch around to cheesy Bollywood pop, 50s rock, and 80s disco hits. A small man with a bucket head twirls on the dance floor like a dervish. It's called Sufi whirling and offered as a meditation class this afternoon, which I join. Sufism is a mystical form of early Islam, and the poet Rumi, its most famous artist, whose words I can relate to. But I never knew what whirling has to do with it all. The instructions are simple. Point your right arm up and your left one down, focus on your upper hand, and start turning around on the spot against the clock. After 5 minutes of spinning, I feel an ecstatic high. Fantastic! I can finally let go of all my thoughts. After 15 minutes, I feel dizzy, then nauseous. After half an hour, I almost collapse and stagger out of the hall. Because there are no places to lie down anywhere in this impeccable institution, I sink into the manicured lawn. My husband finds me there after the session. He is on an ecstatic whirling high. Best thing so far, he claims, while I'm too queasy to attend the evening talk in the pyramid. My first bout of sickness in India hasn't come from food poisoning, but from meditation.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me read that.
Yes, yes. Mm. Oh, lovely. So
B. Schofield had to go into hiding quite a lot, didn't she?
Yeah.
Have you had much conflict for your writings?
Yeah, I mean, during the Centrepoint research, yes, there were some attacks. And also after the book came out, some of the former children, for instance, the children of Bill Potter, there were some online attacks, and I sent them an email and said, hey, I think you got the wrong end of the stick here, and so on. So it's been, and also my book's really thoroughly legally checked to make sure I can't be sued. I was worried about Agama Yoga, but no. All good. And Gloryvale, they luckily don't even, they never, you know, deal with the media, and they have bigger fish to fry there in the courts. So in that sense, it was okay. But just lately, I've come on the radar of ISTA, the organization, you know, that I've moved in for many years myself, and that I also reflect on a little bit in the book, why I loved it and now why I'm critical about it. So that doesn't feel very comfortable, and but it was also to be expected, because there is more and more of a call-out happening at the moment. And, of course, if organizations feel under pressure and they have an internal maybe turmoil around that or discussions, or it's often that the messenger gets shot. And I mean, that's to expect it. As an investigative journalist, you have to have a thick skin. But in this case, it's quite personal, because the people who are now talking, you know, openly online badly about me and saying all sorts of things, they were once my friends. So it's this coming to close. So,
and that is the skin in the game.
That's the skin in the game. But hey, I do hope that all this journalism that I'm doing, and also others, that it actually leads to more awareness and some reforms, and that a lot of these organizations who actually have a lot of good stuff to offer, that they can do better, and it's actually that they see this as an opportunity to get rid of their predators and reform themselves. And I think I wish they would take a harder look at themselves instead of, you know, attacking people who are bringing some things to light.
Yeah. So tell us in that respect, tell us about Baz, the Australian Baz, who was an Agama penitent.
Oh, Israeli, you mean, yeah?
Oh, was he Israeli?
That's fine.
Australian.
Oh, it's interesting. Yeah. You picked him out because, yeah.
Yeah, he was.
So
yeah.
I think from all these three main cults in my book, I always spoke to, it just sort of happened that way, I always also spoke to some of the alleged or convicted predators. I mean, because I also went into Gloryvale and surprised Howard Temple, the current leader there, and did an interview. He didn't quite realize it was an interview, because he probably thinks women don't actually hold any power to publish anything, even though I told him they do. Anyway, Baz it's not his real name, but he's a young Israeli guy who was called out in the whole shitstorm around Agama as one of the predatory males. And he did something pretty amazing. This is why I'm really glad he's in the book and that you mention him, because he really tried to redeem himself and understand what he had done. And he said if he'd stayed in there longer, he would have done far worse things. And because he was groomed in a way by the Swami to be a certain type of male. He had come straight out of the Israeli army, went to India, and then ended up in this, wanted to do some hardcore yoga, ended up in Agama, not because he wanted to be a predator, but because he wanted to learn a very sort of traditional style of tantra yoga. That's why people go into these groups. And then he was on this trajectory of, you know, in this culture where he was groomed to be a certain type of male, and he didn't have the awareness, and he certainly didn't have the reflection of others around him that what he was doing was wrong and was transgressive. But he took those steps afterwards. And this is also something I love talking about, because for me, it's not even so much about what people have done. I mean, some things, like we talked about Louise, the girl in the caravan before, some things are totally unforgivable, yeah, and more people should be in jail for what they've done with, you know, in those groups, and pay a price for it, and justice hasn't been done for a lot of people. But it's, for me, it's not just about what have people done, let's say, on the lesser scale, but what have they done since the system fell, or since things have come to light, since there's been a call out, since there's been media. And that for me is a crucial point, you know, because I don't know, I can't speak for myself what I would be like in a system like that, or as a male, or as a leader who's been put on a pedestal and has all this adulation and doesn't have anything in check anymore, that checks on him, or we just don't know. We want to always think of ourselves as the superheroes or the whistleblowers, at least I do, you know. But I don't really know. I haven't been put to the test. I haven't lived in a regime. I haven't lived in Nazi Germany, or, you know, even just if you put it in this big context. So I have compassion for why people become bystanders or enablers, and but what have they done after the fall? And that's for me, you know, where Bez comes in, and also where I'm holding people now more accountable, also with my book, where I say, hey, you know all this, and you're still saying that. You haven't learned. You're still blaming the victims of Centrepoint. You're still holding on to your old narrative, and that's where I draw the line. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You write in here that in the Agama, you were talking to one of the people at Agama, and who said, first off, no one goes to yoga because they're fine, a Canadian tells me, who doesn't want to reveal which city he lives in or what he does for a living, because he fears being associated with Agama could hurt his career. The Zen of the teachings was incredible, and that's why it's so messed up.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the key messages, is that there's always something good. If there wasn't something good in the first place, no one would be there. And this is also what makes it so difficult, because especially afterwards, how do you... And Bez went through the same thing. He had to separate, like, what was really messed up, patriarchal sort of pickup artistry. Actually, they were learning that in some of the masculinity courses, Agama. What was wrong and what were good parts of the teachings they learned? How do you separate that out? And I've heard the same from people who've come out of Christian cults. You know, some of them completely lost their faith. They never ever want to set foot in a church again or hear about God. But then that can also be really, really difficult, because there's a sense of losing your whole culture. So how do you find your own God, so to speak? How do you find your new religion without making, you know, without that becoming oppressive again? And I think that's why leaving cults is also so complex, and not many people, not many counselors understand that and can really go there and understand the complexity that, yes, you're dealing often with, you know, with sexual abuse, unfortunately, with violence on many levels, with exploitation, but also with this, deep, deep confusion of, but there was something good. And often the good is also the sense of community and the kind of tightness that you had, or maybe it's trauma bonding, but, you know, the closeness. I know a lot of people who always seek for that again and again. And to some level, I've done that too. You know, it's like this lost paradise that you want to find again. And the cult experts, they call it cult hopping. And you see, it's a phenomenon. You see over and over again, people have come out of certain groups and they've fallen into others where they think, that's just what only the good stuff is, like the community and amazing teaching, and this is a really good teacher, and he's not a predator, and guess what, you know, it looks good, and then a few years later, they're in the same boat. Yeah.
Were the predatory men, were there men that came to the cults because they could safely be predators? Did you ever meet...
You mean as cult leaders, or just men in
just
the cults?
Just men in general.
I mean... There are no studies on that. I can't really analyze that. Mm-hmm. I think Centrepoint had a reputation over the years, so I'm sure, from what I've heard, it did attract predatory men, also predatory women. I mean, to some degree, we're all predators. I would say, I mean, it might sound a bit woo-woo or tantric, but I think we all have, you know, a predatory... We all have sides in us that we don't know. They could come out under the right circumstances. That's what I mean. And if that's pushed out, and if you're given permission to be that, yeah? So it's hard to say, were people groomed and turned into predators, or did it really attract predators? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I would like to believe that good people went there with the right intentions, and then they would turn... You know, it's like, again, looking at a totalitarian system or Nazi Germany or so, you know, people can be influenced and manipulated, and it brings out the worst in them.
Perhaps something like the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. where we know now that there was systematic pedophile and protection of pedophile priests. Yeah. So but it's a widespreading cultural institution, the Catholic Church now. But they're very wealthy. I mean, Vatican City has its own postcode. What's the difference between that an occult?
Well, we touched on that before, and it's not like I have a clear-cut answer on that. And I want to also be careful not to fixate on that too much, because it's not about that we can slap that label, oh, that's a cult, and if it's not a cult, then it's okay, because that's not the case. It's a scale.
Yeah.
If you look at some of the worst cults that we know in history, like Jonestown, who's heard of the Jonestown massacre, right? I mean, late 80s, by the way, let's not call it a mass suicide. It was a massacre, yeah? People were coerced. People, they killed their children. They had to. They had people held at gunpoint to drink the, wasn't the Kool-Aid, it was the Flavor-Aid. Anyway, Jonestown, the People's Temple, for like first 10 years or so, they were pretty cool. They were Marxists, they were social justice warriors, they were anti-racist, yeah? It's not like something, I mean, maybe Scientology is a bit of an exception, and Gloria probably too, but mostly not all groups start off as clear-cut cults or even with the intention to be a cult. They turn into that. So it's a sliding scale, and I think the same is true with religion. You know, they are also reformed cults. The Hare Krishnas apparently have done a lot of work to reform themselves. According to some of their survivors from their boarding schools, they said not enough, right? But at least the attempts are there. Or Kundalini yoga, you know, some people still think it's a cult, but at least they've had a massive sort of cleanup action and a report, and they're trying, you know, to look at what went wrong. And so things can change if they're done right. Yeah. But
and what are you working on at the moment?
Actually, all this. I mean, of course, you know, I'm quite passionate about this topic, and a lot of people come to me, and I'm helping people behind the scenes in New Zealand as well from various groups who want to have a voice, and I would love to see an anti-cult agency spring up in New Zealand. It's desperately needed. So I'm a bit of a networker, and I run workshops. I have a little talk workshop called How Not to Start a Cult. Maybe I can... It's more about spotting the red flags.
And do you have a special robe that people have to wear? And how much is it?
Actually, when I held it for the first time, the inaugural in the run of this workshop was at Kiwi Burn, the New Zealand Burning Man Festival, and I did wear a sort of white gown. I was channeling the film Midsommar. So, you know, sometimes you've got to have a bit of a sense of humour with that as well. Without, yeah, it's a fine line to walk, yeah. Mm.
So you're just... exploring this to the full, and in the back
yes.
there is lots of further reading for anybody who wants to look further into this. And I will again say, if anybody has been upset or triggered, please don't suffer in silence. Do not be alone. Reach out. Contact Lifeline on 131114. Talk to a friend. And if it's a friend who's in trouble... talk to your friends, reach out and connect, because silence is how it breeds, yeah?
Yeah, and don't mock and shame people who fall into something. It's quite similar to, you know, people who have fallen down rabbit holes of misinformation. Just try and create some normality with them and maybe not talk about the cult. Give them, show them there's a world outside of the group that they're in and that it's a good world and there are things, you know, because it maybe, I think it's 80% of people come out of cults eventually. They don't usually don't stay in there forever, and something's got to give at some point. And it's so important, if you can be that friend who hasn't mocked and shamed them and hasn't told them they're stupid but still there for them, that can make all the difference, that they can land again on the other side. So
hold a safe space for them.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing this to our attention. Thank you for writing with such warmth and humour. Anke Richter.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.